Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this Lowy Institute AusPNG Network event, engaging young Australians and Papua New Guineans in the political process. My name is Anna Kirk. I'm a research associate in the Melanesia program at the Institute. I'm joined by some very impressive young leaders from Australia and Papua New Guinea who are working to engage their peers in the political process. Let me introduce the panel. Ariane Kassman is the Interim Executive Director of Transparency International PNG. Barbara Thomas is the Executive Director of The Voice Inc., a youth leadership development organisation running programs in PNG's major universities. Lachlan McPhee is the PNG Programs Director at Oaktree, Australia's largest youth-led development agency. And finally, Benson Salo is the Group Indigenous Opportunities Manager at Australian Unity. Benson is also of Aboriginal and Papua New Guinean heritage. I'd like to invite him to give an acknowledgement of country.
Cool. Thanks, Anna. Today we are actually on the lands of the Wurundjeri and the Boonwurrung. But I thought I might just share a little quick story. So I grew up in Tamworth, which is Gomeroi country. And the elders up there used to tell us this story about this idea when we pass away, our spirit returns to this place that they call the Warrumbull. And the Warrumbull is Gomeroi for the Milky Way. And it says that the old men camp by the fires, or camp by the river, which is the Warrumbull, and they light the fires to call our spirits home. And when we pass away, we go and sit by those by the river up there and reflect on the life that we've just had, the late night philosophical conversations, the deep and meaningful conversations with friends and loved ones. And when it's our time to return back to this cycle, we come in the form of shooting stars and we lay within Mother Earth. And then when we're born, it's not so much this idea of conception, it's more around this idea of your spirit choosing who you're meant to be. And the reason why I've always loved that story and it was told over and over again as we're growing up by the wonderful elders up in Tamworth, it's because it reinforces this this element of a sense of purpose, or the challenges that we're meant to face the challenges that we face in our time are into our challenges, and the people that we're meant to meet and connect with are the people that share this same cycle as us. It also talks about this fierce urgency of now, and again that link back to this sense of purpose and the sense of impact that we're meant to have within our lives, or a purposeful life. And it's actually with that understanding of us, being within this room in 2017, it's actually with that I truly acknowledge that we are on traditional lands, and pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and honour their continuing connection to this country and to the rivers that surround us here.
Thank you. So before we get started on the discussion, I wanted to tell you about the AusPNG Network. The network is an initiative the Lowy Institute runs with the support of the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade to enhance the people-to-people links between Australia and PNG and deepen the understanding of PNG in Australia. Launched in 2013, the network came out of an acknowledgement from governments on both sides of the Torres Strait that the strong links and relationships that existed between our two countries at the time of independence have deteriorated, particularly among the younger generation. There are a number of reasons why building the people-to-people links back up deserves dedicated attention. Australia and PNG have a unique relationship, with ties spanning historical, economic, political, cultural, and sporting spheres. PNG is Australia's nearest neighbour. Only 4 kilometres of the Torres Strait separate our two countries. And many Australians don't appreciate the depth of our shared history, which goes far beyond the Kokoda Track and wartime experiences that most would associate with PNG. For example, a number of Australians don't realise that PNG was formerly a colony of Australia, and of course will mark 42 years of independence this year. The AusPNG Network is working to build new links between Australians and Papua New Guineans, promote existing connections like the partnerships between Oaktree and TIPNG and The Voice, and contribute to a more nuanced understanding of PNG in Australia. We do this through our events. The flagship event is the annual AusPNG Emerging Leaders Dialogue, which brings together 10 young Australians and 10 young Papua New Guineans to discuss priority national issues for each country and their shared challenges. Benson and Barbara are both alumni of the Emerging Leaders Dialogue. We also have a website, auspng.lowyinstitute.org, and we are active on both Facebook and Twitter. The theme for this evening's discussion is engaging young Australians and Papua New Guineans in the political process. Youth engagement is an essential issue for people interested in the enhancement of the understanding of PNG in Australia and our shared challenges. Today's conversation will be broad. First, we'll talk about how each panelist works to engage young people in political processes, especially in the lead up to PNG's elections in July this year. We'll then move on to the different contexts for young people from each country with political aspirations. We'll finish by discussing the common issues for young Australians and Papua New Guineans before going to the audience for questions. So while you're listening to the discussion, start thinking of questions on the topics that grab your attention. I'd like to start by asking each panellist to tell us more about their work and how it engages young people. I'll start with Ariane.
Good evening, everyone. I work for Transparency International PNG as the Interim Executive Director, but my work in the anti-corruption sector started when I was in high school and a member of the Youth Against Corruption Association. And I went on to coordinate the Youth Against Corruption Association for 5 years before moving up into this new role. I think in terms of engaging young people in the political process, I think in my role, it has been more getting young people to understand what that process is and what does it mean to be part of decision-making in Papua New Guinea. It's new. It's new for young people to be in that space. And so I see my role as trying to create that platform for young people and getting them ready, building their capacity to be able to step into that space, own that space, and take responsibility also when they get into that space.
Barbara? Good night, everyone. My name is Barbara. I'm the executive director for The Voice Inc. The Voice Inc. is a youth development organization that works with young people in universities and high schools. So it started as a student movement in 2007. There were not a lot of spaces when, you know, in university that young people can come and meet and talk about what was happening in the country. A lot of the spaces were based on, you know, your cultural, your background and ethnic background. And so there was a missing space there that was needed to bring young people from different backgrounds and a safe space as well, too, where they can come and talk about the challenges that were happening in the community and how they, as young people, could start influencing and making a difference. And that was sort of the birth of The Voice. Young people coming together, recognizing that they could start creating change, they could start contributing meaningfully in the community. And it's from the University of Papua New Guinea, it's grown into something bigger than, we'd like to say bigger than ourselves. It's expanded into other universities, state-run universities in Papua New Guinea. It's become an incorporated association, and we run what we call Centers for Leadership, essentially spaces where young people can come together and talk about a lot of the conversations in PNGS are on the problems, you know, and sometimes it's depressing as a young person when you're confronted with all the challenges and all the problems. But then how can you start to ignite those conversations that inspire hope and get young people thinking at a deeper level? Get young people thinking at the systems and what needs to happen to create those systemic changes that need to happen. And so one thing that we want to do and we promote through our spaces is getting young people to think politically, you know, process oriented. Think of a challenge right now and, you know, what needs to be done. So our challenges are big. We understand and we appreciate that, you know, change happens. It's a gradual process. But how do you get people to start thinking about the process that is that is needed to create that change and finding themselves leading that process as well?
Lachlan?
Yeah, great. Thanks very much. And I think some really interesting questions that we can maybe explore a little bit later on as well. So I work for Oaktree and I look after our programs that are in Papua New Guinea. And I think the main area of work that we're really excited about at the moment is the potential for youth participation in development practice. Mm. So getting young people involved in kind of what would normally be seen as like the behind the scenes or nuts and bolts kind of approaches to development that occur in PNG and other countries as well. So we really want to avoid Disengagement with all political action, and development is political action, just because the sort of traditional forms of political engagement haven't been very fruitful for young people. So I think that there are lots of young people in Papua New Guinea and Australia that have something to contribute to create a fairer and more just society, but many of the norms and values of the culture and society in both countries sort of prohibit young people from fully participating. So what we need to do is have norms changed. We need to focus on shaping implicit or explicit values of the two countries, and the way that we go about doing that is really critical as well.
Denson?
So I've kind of aged out of the youth space, which is actually a very sad realization when when you no longer fit this the youth.
I think you still fit.
Oh, thanks, Hannah. but in 2011, I was appointed the Australian Youth Representative to the United Nations, and I had the opportunity of travelling right around Australia, engaging young people, understand what drives them, what issues impact them, and also what kind of issues they'd like to have an impact on, or what kind of world would they like to inherit, essentially. And within this, my time over in New York, so I was just leading negotiations on the on two resolutions, but it was actually my reflections on the UN and my time across there and the disconnect in rhetoric between what's happening at the international level to what's happening at the national level, and then a further disconnect between what's happening at a grassroots level and people's voices or young people's voices being reflected at a national level. There's a great disconnect. So it was actually... It was that kind of challenge. Well, how can we almost? There's an element of kind of how can we decentralize power to return it back into communities to empower young people's voices because they are essentially the experts in their own experience to better voice the issues that they're facing, but then also have a solutions mindset. How can we establish a solutions mindset and then our role really is and then I guess the system's role is to create pathways or channels in which people's voices can actually be heard to affect positive change. And so that's kind of my, like, the Australian kind of experience and stuff that I kind of wrestle with here is around this idea of decentralizing power and creating platforms for young people's voices to be heard. But then also there's a lot of similarities between, levels of education and participation within the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community as well as up in Papua New Guinea. And my family's from the west coast of New Island Province and also West Lavongai up in the broader New Island Province. And there is also this, there is not a sense of apathy, there is a great thirst for learning and education. It's more around the tools or this underlying sense of purpose of what's driving people to kind of connect with what's possible out there in order to kind of, facilitate change within systems. So that I'm interested in that area around how can we better engage people in a system when the system doesn't necessarily reflect them.
Yeah. A lot of very interesting questions that we can explore tonight. Before we do that, though, I thought it would be interesting to talk more about the political context in Papua New Guinea and what that means for young people with political aspirations. We are here in Melbourne, so the audience might not have a very good understanding of what the political landscape is like in PNG and how it's evolved and what it might look like in the future. So I thought, Ariane, you could start by giving us a quick run through.
So I'd like to go through just explaining our political party system a bit. So when we have elections, it is the party with the largest number of candidates that are voted in that are invited to form government. And so during voter education, we are encouraging our voters and our citizens to find out what policies parties are putting forward. But there is a big gap in that currently in the country. Papua New Guineans are not sure what political parties are doing, what their policies are, and then we vote a number of people in, and then we have an issue with what the parties are putting forward as their policies. So when we see this gap, we're trying to fill this gap with just engaging people in these discussions with political parties. The systems is there, it's set up, but no one has an understanding of how it works. We are trying to start with the young people, and so we've partnered with the Integrity of Political Parties and Candidates Commission to just work with the young people during youth forums and just allow young people to ask questions about how our system works, why it's set up this way, and why these parties are formed. Our government system is set up in a way where people are invited to nominate or become candidates for the elections. Whether they choose to be part of a party or independent is up to them. But if they choose to be part of a party, they have to go by what policies the party has. And so, for example, in the last election, the party that was invited to form government was PNC. And their main priority areas were to provide free education, free health. And that's been their policies all throughout. So even though Papua New Guineans might feel that we have other things that we should be prioritizing, when these parties campaigned, they campaigned along those lines. And that's what they will stick to over the 5 years. So it's also getting our people to understand the political party system. And so when they go to the voting booth, they understand that it's not just voting for the person, but also the whole party. I'll let Barbara, I think, explain a bit more about our political context in PNG.
Yeah, I think there's a need for more people to understand the political processes. There's a lack of understanding of those processes, and so people don't understand their power, I guess, and how powerful they are. But over the years, there's a new trend that's happening, I can say, that more people want to know. They want to be engaged in the process. They don't want to be ignorant anymore. You know, they don't want to accept, you know, the status quo right now. And they know and understand that the current understanding of leadership or the context of it, and also, you know, our development paradigms, you know, they see the challenges there and they understand that there is a need that needs to be addressed. And more young people, more and more people are starting to, you know, make a lot of noise. Social media has had, an influential role in the way people are starting to have access to information that usually wasn't easily available. But then with that as well, too, some of the challenges with that is that access is that misrepresentation of that information, so not the correct information spread there. So I think one of the biggest challenges is ensuring that we're empowering our people to understand the basic processes because they do want to. They're really hungry. They want to be involved in the process. And last year, a number of you would have known, if you follow PNG media and news, there was a big student unrest up in PNG across all the state universities, and that really got people thinking, you know, about the caliber of leaders that we're putting into our parliament, and you know, our systems, you know, the so-called big men type of leadership, and then you think about, you know, understanding what people understand around political parties. And I think a term that has been coined around like developmental leaders, you know, people coming together, working as a collective to address a particular problem, you know. And now people realizing that it's more than just one person who can make a change, you know. You need a collective. You need people coming together, people who identify that there is a challenge, there is a problem, and that action needs to be taken. And so more young people, I guess, one of the student-led protests didn't end well. I guess they didn't achieve the outcomes that they wanted to, mainly because it was fueled out of a lot of frustration and anger, you know, angry. So it didn't really have the kind of impact that they wanted to. But some of the outcomes of that protest has been some of the student groups, the provincial groups, have started to go into the provinces and have their own conversations with their people in the villages, in the communities, saying, you know what, we've got the power and we're voting, you know, the type of leaders that we're voting into parliament is, you know, the results are a result of our actions. And that was amazing because previously in the past, when you want to get young people to go into the community to do something, there has to be an incentive. But now they're funding it, self-funding it themselves. You know, they're getting their relatives to organize vehicles, you know, get cash around it. And they're driving the conversations in the community, which is something that hasn't happened before. And I think that's something, that's the beginning of something great in this nation. You're starting conversations, you know. It will take time, but it's a mindset shift. And the more people who are aware, engaged, the more conversations that are happening at all levels, and more young people, like especially with their passion and their zeal and their hunger to, you know, really change the status quo, I think now more than ever you have a more engaged population who want to be engaged. The hunger is there. The challenge is informing that they, ensuring that they're equipped with the information, you know, equipped with that knowledge. When they're sharing it with the people in the communities, they're empowering the people in the communities. Yeah.
So I'd like to ask about how young people can enter into politics in PNG. Is that an easy thing to do?
No. there's, you know, no, actually, there are no platforms, you know, for leadership development. You have our, we have political parties, they don't have youth wings. We have, you know, we want to have more seats in parliament, well, aside from youth, women, but there's no special parliamentary group for that as well, to our program. Normally, we wait until the final year to do parliamentary special programs for equipping women, especially, you know, who want to get into parliament. There's a big gap and there's a big need for pathway programs, I guess, to equip people and young people. We don't have a... It's challenging, especially because we have a youth development authority. We should have youth councils, provincial youth councils, but we don't have that. So essentially, spaces for young people to come together and talk about what's happening, to be the voice, is essentially for their districts or their provinces. It's not non-existent. And so civil society, such as ourselves and Arian and a number of other organizations, try to fill that gap as best as we can. But it's, you know, it's a immense challenge, I guess. And so, yeah, it's a challenge. And even the Register for the Political Party said it is a challenge. You know, young people, what are the pathways? And I know a number of young people who are actually standing for election this year, you know. And they say they have a number of challenges. They've just, you know, out of passion, they want to do this and they want to drive and, you know, put their hands up for public office. But are they prepared well for it? Do they have, you know, the support to be able to do this? And most of them are running as independents too. So, you know, political parties see young people as a risk as well too. Risk in investment, I don't know. In investing in them to hold public office. So essentially, there is no pathway there. There is a big gap there as well too. So, yeah.
So just briefly before we move on to the Australian context, could you both tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing in the lead up to the elections?
So for the Youth Against Corruption Association, what we've tried to do is partner with the PNG Electoral Commission and run a lot of mock elections. PNG use the limited preferential voting system. And so when you go to the voting booth, you have to write. So one, you have three preferences, first, second, third, and you have to write either the candidate number or the name of the candidate. And, you know, literacy is a huge problem in Papua New Guinea. And so when we have forms like this, the next challenge is making sure that our people understand what they need to write. Because if they miss one line, then it's an informal vote and it won't be counted. So for us, it was starting off with getting young people to understand what happens on polling day, who is present at the polling station, so they know when they go there what they're observing and what is supposed to happen at a polling station. From my experience observing the 2012 elections, because people are not aware of who is supposed to be in the polling booth, you can have 50 people in the polling booth at one area. And then you go to another area where no one is there to vote. So what we wanted to do was just give young people an understanding of our limited preferential voting system, and more importantly, how the counting takes place, because that is another challenge in itself. We've had a few outreach activities where we go out and talk about the elections itself, eligibility, who can vote. More importantly, where can you vote? Our laws state that you have to be living in a particular area for 6 months or more in order to vote in that area. And if you've moved, you have to move your details as well to the electorate that you're now living in. But what we're finding in PNG is that we have people that live in the city for all their life, go back to the village and vote in the village and then come back to the city. And that's wrong. So we try to make sure that we're getting that information out to the people and also for them to understand why it's set up this way. Nomination of candidates is different as well. And so people will have to understand why it's okay for a particular person to stand in that area, even if they're not from that area. So what makes them eligible there too? But what we do have coming up is a youth forum with the Integrity of Political Parties and Candidates Commission. And hopefully at some stage we can have a discussion about post-election. What can young people do in the next 5 years leading up to the next election? What role can we play in making sure that our elections are free, fair and safe moving forward?
Thank you. I think we might have to move on to the Australian context. Lachlan and Benson, how do you see the Australian political landscape today? And what do you think about the role of the younger generation? Big question.
Thanks, Benson. I think it's a really interesting situation you have at the moment because there are lots of prominent issues that affect young people very, very deeply. You know, if we're talking about housing affordability or underemployment or climate change, I mean, these are all issues that affect young people proportionately more. And yet there is very little conversation or seemingly political will to deal with any of these really pressing issues. So I think that has led to a situation where a lot of young people feel quite disillusioned and quite disenfranchised by the political process as it stands. And you have a situation where young people don't necessarily want to engage in the traditional means of getting involved in politics, whether that's joining a political party or voting for a major party. You know, you're seeing increasing trends towards minor parties and independents, and if you look at voting and things like that. I think the critical thing is that there's a lack of representation at the moment with the current crop of parliamentarians, and that's from both parties, both major parties. And if we are going to deal with some of these issues, we have to change some of the norms around the ways that young people are allowed to participate. You know, a lot of the time a young person will stick their head above the parapet and say something like, oh, it's really unfair about negative gearing, or it's, you know, climate change is a massive issue, we need to be dealing with this urgently right now. And you'll have a politician come out and say, oh, you know, you millennials, you just like to whinge, or, you know, you're not a leaner, but a leaner.
No,
so you have these really pithy, like quick snapback, you know, kind of comebacks that most politicians rely on without critically engaging with the actual complaints or the actual, you know, thoughts of young people. And that is what is at the root, I think, of the current malaise we find ourselves in.
Benson, would you like to add a comment?
Yeah, sure. So absolutely, young people are feeling disillusioned. I think it was in 2013, there was over 200,000 registered young people that actually didn't vote. And with the conversation is around, well, is there anything then in which we want to vote for, which young people would like to vote for? And unfortunately, you know, when we do look at our current representation in the halls of Parliament House, it is leaning a very conservative you know, politics at the moment, or very conservative state of politics within Australia. The one thing that I've spoken about in the past was this idea of how do we ignite a lead a resurgence in political participation in our generation. And there's this notion that was coined a little while back from Martin Luther King. And it was this term, the disciplined nonconformist. And it's actually part of this quote. It says, the hope of a livable, secure world lies with disciplined nonconformists that dedicate their lives to peace, justice, and brotherhood. And when we look around at our current state of affairs here in Australia and, you know, even internationally, we don't see those disciplined nonconformists, the people that are willing to work within a system to change a system, the people that are willing to kind of raise their hand in a room full of yes men and say, no, not this time. You can't deny someone their rights and you know, lock them up in an offshore detention centre. You can't wind back public radio, and you can't wind back the Racial Discrimination Act. And so these are the fundamentals of what makes a society great in regards to democracy. But we're not seeing people that are working within a system to be the jealous guardian of democracy in Australia, and that's the biggest challenge that we're seeing here, is that young people are looking at a system that doesn't reflect them in face, doesn't reflect them in values and in principles, and doesn't reflect them in age or representation. And I think that's where we're seeing this great disconnect or this sense of disillusionment, is young people are looking at, well, what are the other options? And this is why we're seeing such a surgence in membership with the Oak Tree Foundation, the Australian Youth Climate Change Coalition, is that these issue-based platforms are the ones that are driving the engagement. What I would like to see is actually not only political parties, but representing young people, but actually representing progressive ideals right across their policy platforms.
So how do you think that we should be trying to spark young people's interest in politics?
So I think for me, it's not only understanding the system and understanding what works and what doesn't work, but there's also these things, I call them kind of proof points in regards to how powerful an individual's voice can actually be. And this is where it's really important for us as a society to invest in grassroots initiatives and to support, this element of curiosity within young people. And this is where, when you look at curiosity, it's not only, the asking the hows and the whys, but it allows a young person to view themselves differently in the relation to the community around them. And it's actually with that element of curiosity in which you can start underbedding this element of values. And in Papua New Guinea, you still hold strong to this, the ideal of being a Christian nation. But furthering that, and also, fortunately, within our Aboriginal communities, there's a deep culture there that is actually built upon these foundations of values. And I think it is also about reflecting on what are these values that connect us as people, as individuals, but then also what informs our passions and what drives us and establishes this thing, which is around what I stand for, but then also what I don't stand for. And it's in this space of what I don't stand for in which you can wrap social action tools around. You can connect networks. You can really inspire people to say, you know what, I'm going to be that person who's going to raise my hand in a room full of yes men and say no. And I think that's the kind of generation that we need to, we are being able to develop, but then empower at that grassroots level.
Yeah. And Lachlan, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on something you mentioned about, how do you engage someone's curiosity and get them thinking about a particular issue and to figure out where they stand. And then the next step from there is to take action based on that stand. So one of the things that I found most interesting of work that I've done recently was write a submission for the foreign policy white paper process, the consultation process that was happening. I think they're going to be writing the submission and drafting things up until September this year or something like that. But it was an opportunity to contribute to the debate about what Australia's foreign policy should be across the next 10 years. And I found that process really interesting because it forces you to sit down and go, what actually do I think about like Australia's foreign policy over the next 10 years? Like what is relevant to me? Like, how can I contribute meaningfully to that debate and sit down and come up with a position and then, feed it into this whole massive bureaucratic machine, then it might just not even do anything. But it's the act of like actually putting your voice out there and writing it down and thinking about where your stance is.
And a part of this process is also identifying what Australian values are too. Did you think about that when you were writing your submission?
Yeah, I think we have we have to move in a more outward-focused, kind of enlightened conception of what's in our self-interest and think more about, you know, how we fit in with our region, whether we're, you know, a bastion of European, like European values out here in the Pacific, or if we need to be more engaged with, like, the, you know, the cultures and the history that surrounds us. Yeah.
I was recently looking at the last white paper from 2003, I think, and the values they identified were tolerance, perseverance, and mateship. And I thought that they were really good values that we should use to think, reframe the way we think about our relationship with the Pacific in particular, and especially PNG, our nearest neighbour. I think it's a good point to move on to our shared challenges as young Australians and Papua New Guineans. Ariane, you've been a very prominent voice in the climate change debate in PNG and the broader region. Do you think this is an issue that young Australians and Papua New Guineans should be collaborating on?
Definitely. I do work with 350 in PNG. And so in Newcastle in 2014, we took part in the blockade. So blocking off Newcastle port for a full day. To show Australia that we are not going to sit down and allow you to bring this type of destruction to the Pacific. Every time you open a coal mine, every time you allow for this to happen, there are islands in the Pacific, there are people in the Pacific that are losing their homes. And so that was a strong message we wanted to bring in 2014. And we worked together with 350 Australia, the Australian Youth Climate Coalition as well. And then, of course, there was a group of Indigenous youth that were having a climate conference during that week. And so what happened was, you know, we had 30 young Pacific Islanders coming out to Australia and not sure about, you know, if this was something that we were going to do without getting arrested first. But we had over hundreds of Australian young people that came out on their kayaks and joined with us on that day. And it was such a beautiful sight to see. Australia being big brother to the Pacific plays a huge role in shaping that that narrative for us. And I think there's so much potential to collaborate on the issue of climate change. Australia, again, is our nearest neighbor. All of the Pacific look to Australia. And so it will be very important for our young people to engage in that discussion around climate change as we move forward, because it is a huge issue globally. But more importantly for the Pacific islands, people risk losing their homes if no action is taken to reduce some of the impacts that are being caused by our closest neighbour as well. So.
Lachlan, I wanted to ask you about the difficulties in the transition from education to employment for young people in both countries. What do you think explains it?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, and it's at the root of a lot of the disengagement and disillusion that we see with politics and participation in social life more generally with young people. So if you think about, you know, what is the components of your identity, so much of it is what you is tied up in, like what you imagine your future will be, what kind of future you imagine the world, and how you can contribute to that. And employment is tied up really strongly with that idea of, you know, what can I contribute? What can I actually bring to this world that will...
Not even just these kind of higher level ideas.
Yeah.
It's the first question somebody asks you when they meet you.
Yeah,
what do you
exactly.
Do?
You know, it's such a fundamental part of your identity. So to have a situation where so many young people struggle to move from studying full-time, perhaps at university or high school level, into full-time, you know, formal sector work is just another way that we are prevented from realising the futures and hence the identities that we imagine for ourselves. And that's what's tied up with that idea of disillusion with the current system that we have.
And what do you think can be done about it?
It's a really challenging question. I don't think we could probably spend another 2 hours.
Yeah, we don't have that time.
We don't
sorry.
Have that time. So what I would say is that there needs to be a stronger link between universities and high schools and the companies that are going to be employing people. And we need to think more intentionally about what the jobs of the future are going to be, especially in Western developed countries where... automation and robotics is actually destroying a lot of jobs. I'd be interested to hear from Barbara Ariane about what challenges might be faced in PNG and how they could be overcome as well.
So PNG is a really growing youth bulge, I guess, and the situation is you have around 25,000 year 12 students every year and only space for 4,000 students at tertiary institutions. So you can see the majority of young people who don't have access to an opportunity to do something, you know, that's and I guess there's been a number of job employment is a really big opportunities for young people is a really big challenge for Papua New Guinea at the moment. You have a lot of young people, you know, not engaged and angry, and you know it leads to a lot of, you know, the social challenges that we have as well too. And so that is one of the biggest challenges that PNG has, creating opportunities for our young people. That the rate that we're going in terms of our population growth and the rate at which where our current government as well to the emphasis that they're putting on certain things like Ariane touched earlier on education and health. So what they've done is there's free education, but they're not improving the facilities, you know. So the teacher-to-student ratio is crazy. So there's last week in the papers, some teachers at a really big primary school in the city had to be overnighting in their classrooms because they had 80 students. One teacher to 80 students, crazy. I mean, I think it's crazy. And so you have, like, our challenges, you know. At the same time, more young people have access to education, but at what cost? The quality, you know? And that's the same as, so you have a lot of, you know, it's a really big challenge, it's a really big conversation in itself. And just, you know, I think the environment for young people, conducive environment to provide those opportunities for these young people is lacking.
I'd like to speak to that also. With these challenges do come opportunities, and there's huge potential for us to look at entrepreneurship for young people, agriculture. Our country has a focus on extractive industry because we feel that that's where bulk of our revenue comes from. But agriculture is such an important part of Papua New Guinea, and that's where the investment needs to be. Our government needs to start thinking about how do we empower those people in the local communities, in the villages. We have to provide them the knowledge, the skills, the resources that they need to work the land more. And then so when we have crops that we can export, then it will help to build our people's their own, you know, self, and I guess reduce that dependency they have on government. So they feel like, you know, I can do this. Yes, the government will provide some services, but I can take responsibility also for my life, my family, and my community, and I can do something for my people. So
I think we should finish by looking at the bilateral relationship. And sorry, Benson, did you want to add something?
Okay. No, you're right, Anna.
and the state of the relationship between young Australians and Papua New Guineans. How can we improve it?
From an Australian perspective to kind of...
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done and supported around, I guess, the support of governance within organisations. And I think there's a very almost a professional lens in which you could, that Australian organisations could support Papua New Guinean organisations and companies. But I think there's also a fair bit that we are actually lacking in our own systems as well. And so going back to the point around the school to work transitions, and this is an area that I think there's a great connection that we could actually work together on, is ensuring that we're developing young people with transferable skills, that they are the world that they're going to inherit is not reflective of the education system in its current state. And so if it's not within the current education system, then there needs to be other organisations that are out there that are providing those kind of the entrepreneurial skills. But those other we call them soft skills, but, you know, they definitely need to harden up, because they are some really important skills of kind of that future thinking or the element to be able to work across different sectors and different industries. There's a great book by Dan Pink, and he talks about the three elements of motivation. It's around drive, autonomy, and mastery. And I think these are these three elements, or how to achieve these three elements, need to be taught within our education systems to better equip young people. The role that we can play, and I never like that term as the big brother in the Pacific, or referring to our brothers and sisters there as a little brother or a little sister, is that we actually ourselves as a Western world, as a Western society, need to actually be humble in our engagement with Papua New Guineans and understand that we don't have all the answers, that when we sit at a table, that we sit equally at a table, and it's not pushing our will. Because there's a lot of things that we're struggling with here in Australia that we don't openly acknowledge.
That we have shared challenges.
Absolutely. And this is a great thing about the network that the Lowy Institute established. But then also, I think there's great opportunity for exchanges to take place. And that is something that the new Colombo plan was looking to establish with our teachers here in Australia being able to go up and teach and support teachers up in Papua New Guinea. But there's also, again, there's opportunities to bring New Guinean quality, very good quality Papua New Guinean teachers into Australia to show our teachers a thing or two.
All right, I think this is the opportunity to turn to the audience for questions. Before we do that, I'd ask anyone who has a question to please identify themselves and ask a question, not give a statement, and keep your question brief, please. We have microphones. Yes? If you could just wait for the microphone, sorry. Oh.
Thank you, John Ridley. I was stunned by the figure that was quoted about 25,000 students graduating from year 12 and only 4,000 tertiary places. Does that include technical and further education places? Does that mean that only 4,000 of 25 get any further tertiary training?
Yeah, so that's around 4,000 around for universities and around, I think, 6,000, less than 8,000 at the most for technical TVET colleges. The government had come up with a priority to set up more TVET colleges in the provinces. So there was this policy that they would have TVET colleges rolled out in each province and for each district to have at least that, because they recognize the need to have more TVET colleges, but that hasn't happened yet. Yeah, hopefully it will in the future.
But that does present a huge issue around suddenly there's a bottleneck.
Yeah.
But that also leads to frustration within youth populations. So this element of entrepreneurial skills and being able to, drive economic development or even just sustainable development within their own communities is critical. Yeah. There's the young people that I've been fortunate to meet up in Papua New Guinea don't necessarily want to leave their province. You know, this is their family, this is their country. But being able to gain any kind of skills in which they can actually make a serious go at actually making a living in their country, in their lands. If trying to gain those skills, they actually need to leave their province. So in Papua New Guinea, there isn't actually a university. A lot of my countrymen actually fly to Port Moresby or to Lae, and very rarely actually come back. Yeah, and when they do, feel so frustrated with the lack of progress or the lack of opportunity that they simply kind of turn their back on the education system.
Yeah, and I think that's just grade 12 level. It actually starts much lower. So I think we start with, 100,000 primary school students. We have grade 8 exams that cut a huge percentage off, and then grade 10 exams, and then grade 12 exams. So there are a lot of young people falling off at those different levels. And as a country, we need to start thinking about what are we going to do to minimize the number of people getting cut off. We don't have enough schools. We know that, and there is a need for more schools, but then comes the need for more teachers, more resources, enough materials to go out to the schools, and logistically in Papua New Guinea, that is a huge challenge. So what the government did try to do, I think, in the last couple of years was partner with the church through the Church Partnership Program, because the church churches provide a lot of the services like education and health, and trying to see how we can work together better. But it's a huge challenge for education in Papua New Guinea.
Sorry, my name is Ipul. I'm actually a student here at in Melbourne, sponsored by the Australian government. I'm at Deakin University doing my PhD. My question is really to the Australian, but also, you know, carrying on from the issues that the Papua New Guineans have raised forward. I am here because the Australian government has provided that opportunity. But when Barbara talked about the disparity in terms of, you know, the ones going into the higher education. And so in terms of the bilateral understanding, and I know, Lachlan, you said you're putting together the youth framework for international development. Do you see an opportunity where we can start to, rather than having Papua New Guineans coming down here, that Australians could actually go to Papua New Guinea through the APTC program? And, you know, bringing on this issue as well for people with disabilities, this is a big issue. I am the leader for people with disabilities in PNG. I work closely with Ariane Kassman, trying to see how our youth with disabilities also can be empowered. So I think these are the issues that we really need to look at that bilateral level. You know, bringing the top people coming down, but that the bottleneck, you know, that, and looking at the entrepreneurship focus, how we can start to build the capacity in country so that we don't have that issue. And the last thing is, I'm from Manus, and the issue of the asylum seekers has really created a social upheaval in my province at that youth level. So I think these are many of the issues that we need to discuss. Thank you.
Just to clarify, your question was about the bilateral relationship.
Yes,
and how
we can look into the education sector.
Education sector to improve it.
Yeah, and, you know,
and enhance exchange between the two countries.
Something along that line, yes.
Okay, who would like to take that question?
I'll take that one.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your question. And I think it's a really, really key consideration is that so much of the time aid is thought of as a flow of knowledge and expertise and money and experience going across to a developing country and creating change based on that input from outside. I think that is really wrong-headed, and we have a lot to learn from each other, and particularly in Australia, a lot to learn from Papua New Guineans and other Pacific Island countries in many, many different ways. So I would fully support a greater link of exchange, especially on education. I think if you had it set up in such a way that you had potentially an excess of teachers coming through the Australian system that are finding it difficult to find work and were to offer them the opportunity to go to PNG and potentially fill some of those capacity gaps, then that might be a really quick, simple, back-of-the-envelope way of creating further engagement between the two governments and potentially solving some of these problems that we're seeing in both on both sides of the straits, yeah.
Benson?
Yeah, I think there's actually a step before that, and it's a perception thing. It's a challenge of, so even Anna in your opening remarks was talking about that most Australians don't actually realise that that Papua New Guinea was a colony before, 1975. And I think this is the thing, that we're more likely to volunteer over in Thailand or India than actually look to our northern neighbour. And I think there is a lot that needs to be done around, even in our education system, around actually telling Australia's history and our connection within the Pacific region, and creating a narrative that really drives people's that want to actually to be able to connect back up into Papua New Guinea. And there's a lot of people's own personal histories that actually connect them back up to Papua New Guinea, particularly during World War II or during the transition. I think it's about us telling that story and actually finding value in having our connection with Papua New Guinea. And I think that's the point in which it's almost the simple element of building a just a general relationship And then it's actually using that relationship to not only have through the education system and facilitating that exchange, but looking at business as well and how we can kind of support I guess, economic development or even trade between the two nations.
Barbara and Ariane, would you like to add anything?
No, okay. I think you summed it up beautifully.
Like all right, any other questions?
Sana Balai from the Papua New Guinea community here in Melbourne. I'd just like to pick out on the point where you said a threshold from a younger from a dropout as a younger generation. Obviously, this group will most likely not to go beyond education that will empower them to get a job in what we're looking forward to in the economy out there. I'm just wondering whether there is a thing in place where you can link the threshold from the younger children into the communities, because that's where they are in linking the cultural villages to work with them, to empower them in running little business and training them in that area. Because what I'm hearing here is a lot of talks we're talking about is on the upper level. And as the bottleneck, as you mentioned, is the threshold, which is the younger ones. I'm wondering whether there's anything in place for these people here where we can link the cultural things for them, because they live in the village, obviously, to avoid them having the misfit within the communities. Thank you.
I guess the challenge, and I think that's a really good point as well too. And I had a conversation with someone, and then that's how we were talking about development. And what is development? Is it characterized in the big high-rise buildings, or you know, the flyover buildings, or is it, you know, people in their community, you know, happy and having access to, you know, the basics of health and education and able to pursue their dream? And how then do you define that? It was a really interesting, because we're on our journey as well too. So do we define it in the context of the West, or do we define it in our context and what we understand it and our values around what development is and what progress is? And the element of community and people coming together and owning the process as well too, and embracing the values that we have as well too, and developing together as a community. I think one of our biggest challenges is, 80% of Papua New Guineans, they own land. And there's been a lot of controversy around registration, land registration, the ILG. I think the secret is in unlocking the land so that people would have, you know, once they have access to registered land, then they can incorporate groups and have access to bank, you know, services that can help them to develop their land, you know, agriculture, entrepreneurship, you know, a lot of things connected to the land. And so they're trying to think about that. So when you have an incorporated land group, you have the clans in the community come together and they register the land in order to register a business idea or interest, you know. And so in that sense, then you engage everyone in the community or everyone in the village or everyone in the tribe to be involved in a coffee plantation or a cacao plantation or tourism, ecotourism. But our challenge is ensuring that the law, that legislative processes are in place so that it can, I think there's wealth in our land, and if that potential was untapped, I guess, then your community will be involved in, you know, generating that wealth and creating that, and then there would be more opportunities for people, yeah.
So there are some opportunities. The National Development Bank has an incubator program where they're trying to pick out young people that are interested in entrepreneurship and work with them over a long period of time, help build their capacity, and then at the end of it, provide some funding, some seed funding for them. But that's just the National Development Bank, and that's currently only based in Port Moresby. With the way our budget is set up in the local level government and in the districts and in the provinces, the youth youth budget is with the women, with the children, with persons with disabilities. We're all clumped up together in one, and there's not much resources allocated for that one group. So what we need to do is to push for that to be separated, all those sectors separated, and much more resources given to these different sectors. For it would be good if there was a place where young people in the provinces, in the local level, in the districts, could go and apply for funding and get some seed funding to do some activities. But as it is right now, there isn't one that exists. What the government has tried to do through few reforms that they've tried to introduce is push down a lot of the service delivery to the districts. But that comes with its own challenges because our local level government leaders, they're not equipped with the knowledge or the capacity to be organizing projects or to be project managers for something. So we need to build this capacity of those leaders and also open that conversation or that dialogue where young people can participate in their meetings also, which is not something you find really in local communities. In the villages especially, young people in those council meetings or where chiefs gather, that's not something that's common. I think a discussion we had earlier with the International Women's Development Agency. Around how do we interact more with our leaders? Respect is a big thing in Papua New Guinea. And so we as young people need to understand and make sure that we show that respect. And then once we gain it, we gain the trust of our leaders and they will entrust some of this decision making to us. But as young people, we need to also understand our culture, our traditions, and then look at what modernization or what development is going to look like for us. You know, development, like Barbara was saying, is a word that's thrown around so much. When I have young people that come to Port Moresby for the first time, they see development as the flyover that we have or all the roads being sealed. But I think development really is our human resource. How far are we going to develop our human resource? What are we investing in to make sure that our people have all that they need to make sure that they live better lives? So,
Aidan Cranny, La Trobe University. Very quick statement, just to thank Loey for giving us a panel that's firstly majority female and secondly majority non-white. That's pretty rare. I'd just like to say that we began talking about political participation and systems. I think in both Australia and PNG, the political systems are actually deliberately set up to exclude young people's participation. So I'm wondering if the panellists can share with us some ideas on how organisations can work to engage young people civically and politically outside of the systems that currently exist.
Benson, would you like to take that one?
Yeah, sure. So I actually was the founding director of the National Indigenous Youth Leadership Academy back in 2012 following the UN stint. And it was around empowering young people's voices with the tools and the networks around social action to be able to voice or raise their voices at a national level. And so in the space of 2 years, we developed and launched 10 youth-led social action campaigns from everything from climate change to suicide prevention to mental health issues, which consistently comes up when you talk to young people around what are some of the biggest challenges. And so when we're kind of looking at, well, how do we, support young people's voices to have an impact at a national level, we're seeing that there is a trend towards issue-based organisations, like I said before, the Oak Tree Foundation around ending poverty and the AYCC, which is around climate change. And, you know, these are great vehicles as a young person to be able to not only build your network, gain a sense of purpose and understand what drives you, but then also be able to gain the skills that you need to be able to challenge systems. But then there is also a stage in which you unfortunately kind of mature out of it and go, well, actually, is it 10,000 people on the street or is it 10 people in a room that actually make a change? And this is where the debate between the thirst for change, the kind of the instant gratification or the slow burn. And this is the piece that has to be developed in young people is this idea that change is actually incremental. It comes when you least expect it. And there is also a certain point in which it tips, the tipping point, that it also happens. And there is clear indicators, you know, that we've seen of historically looking at the social movements in the 1960s, through the 70s, through the 80s, over the, you know, decades of change in really kind of rupturous kind of times in our world, in which there's clear indicators in which you know that you're building to a tipping point. And I feel that in Papua New Guinea, as well as in Australia, we are building to a tipping point. I think there's a greater tipping point that's coming within PNG in regards to young people's voices, and change is actually being taken place at the political level. I'd love to see a youth-led political party, just saying. but we are coming to a point as well in Australia, and I think it's around being able to develop young people's eyes to be able to be acutely aware of where this tipping point is, how best they can support it. So not everyone needs to be a founder, not everyone needs to be a leader. They need to be, you know, the most active follower in some cases to be able to will that tipping point. And I think we're coming to that, but we do need to develop young people with not only a sense of curiosity, a sense of connection with like-minded people, a sense of purpose, but with the tools in which they can help will that that tipping point. Knowing it might not happen tomorrow, it might happen in 10 years, but that constant sense of will and dedication to a social challenge. I think we're slowly getting there.
I think that's probably a good place to leave it tonight.
Sorry, I talked for way too long. Sorry.
Thank you very much for attending. Thank you to the panelists and to my colleagues who helped us put this together, and to our friends at Oak Tree. I hope you all enjoyed the discussion.
Well done.